Well, as I think I said, I'm an interviewer on the project which is called An Oral History of British Science. Tom and I are aiming to interview over 100 scientists, technicians and engineers over 3 years. We've done one and a bit years, and as Rob said, we're hoping for more funding for a further 100 interviews in the life sciences and in cosmologies, theoretical physics and astronomy and so on. But my strand of the project is called A Changing Planet and focuses on what would now be called Earth sciences, wouldn't have been at the start of our period, but would be now geography, geology, geophysics, glaciology, meteorology, oceanography, atmospheric physics, and modern sciences of climate change. Now, until recently, British Earth scientists were mostly male. In our period, there were very few female academic geologists, geographers, or geophysicists. Institutes of oceanography and meteorology were staffed mainly by male scientists. Plate tectonics was developed in the late 60s in Britain by men. Climate scientists are mostly male. The hole in the ozone layer was spotted by male scientists, and so on. It isn't that existing histories of the earth sciences have missed or excluded women. They, on the whole, weren't there. One way to examine a social practice in which most of the participants are male, in this case science, but it would work equally well for investment banking, I suspect, or golf, or train spotting, or water supply engineering, or commercial radio perhaps, is to consider the particular kinds of masculinity in question. It's not good enough just to say this is male-dominated, but to look at the particular kinds of masculinity we're dealing with. In my first clip, technician Barbara Bowen remembers scientists of the British Antarctic Survey telling stories of their scientific work at overwintering bases in Antarctica.
The young men just went for 6 months or 18 months. They're called FIDs. For short, and they would sort of tell you tales, you know, sort of about raucous parties, and they'd had strange names for undergarments and things like this. There was a sort of South Atlantic jargon, Antarctic jargon for underpants and things like this, you know, this was, they had to be carefully selected to make sure that when 8 of them that were chosen, say, to stay in one station, would all get on with each other if they had to overwinter, which meant that they had to be there in the darkness for 6 months and not be able to do many experiments.
And when you said the FIDs used to come back and you would hear raucous stories about goings on, do you remember any in particular that stand out?
No, just some people have never washed. Shreddies was their underpants after 8 months of being down there. And one wondered whether they ever changed them at all. If you know what I mean, it was mostly just sort of lavatorial type jokes, really. Nothing more than that. But not that I can remember, no.
Shreddies is one term. Do you remember other slang?
No, I can't remember any other words. I don't know why that one stands out, but it just seems typically boyish, lavatorial jokes. That's stupid, really.
So here then, being an Antarctic scientist is sewn up with a very specific kind of services, boys' school, institutionalised, jocular masculinity. And this form of masculinity appears elsewhere in my interviews, in stories of drunken games on research ships, silly names for undersea features, and lewd names for pieces of equipment. In my second clip, John Nye remembers physics teaching in Cambridge's Cavendish Laboratory in the late 40s, in which a slightly darker, formal masculinity plays out. As the clip starts, I've just asked him to recall the number of female students reading physics.
I don't think I was really aware of the of counting numbers. I think in physics, there were probably many, many fewer women than men. If you went into the arts department in English, you would find many more women.
What was specifically male about science then, at this time?
Well, of course, experimentally it was a hands-on thing, and it was just not considered so ladylike to be doing science. I mean, there's a story about Searle. I witnessed some pretty bad bullying by Searle of women, but there's one woman who couldn't get the magnetism experiment to work at all, and she was sent out to take off her stays, which were upsetting the experiment.
They broke her
stays, her corset stays, steel stays, and experiments unsuited to women, you see. That sort of thing would happen. They were considered not suitable for that kind of activity. I mean, Cambridge was a very conservative place.
What was the attitude of the undergraduates to these few women taking science?
Well, they were perfectly tolerant of, in fact, glad to have them there. I mean, after all, there's an enormous shortage of women among all those young men. And, I mean, there weren't enough women for the dancers. And after the war, when the warriors returned wearing their duffel coats and quite a different sort of chap, it was even worse because there really weren't enough women for them.
Now, I think I'd like to argue that one striking aspect of that clip is that being female isn't an internal quality that stops at the skin, if you like. It extends outwards to clothes and further out to bits of magnetic equipment. And more generally in this talk, I'd like to suggest that being a person isn't a matter of an internal, coherent, enclosed subjectivity, but that people are made in relations with places and objects, through relations with things outside of themselves. For example, in the next two clips, the chemistry laboratory as a place offers different ways of being female. Number one.
Could you expand on your reasons for having left university and seeking a job in science that was not in a laboratory setting?
Well, we were then wearing tights, and I ruined so many pairs, and plus the old skirt, because you had lab coats, but the old-fashioned variety, brown with those buttons with the metal peggy, you know, you put, stuck the button in the hole and then stuck the metal peggy in it to keep it in the hole from the other side. And they've got holes in them, and then they penetrated. If you've got something else on, another chemical on it, and went through that hole and it onto your clothes. So I thought, oh, I don't think I want a job where I have to work in a lab all the time. And so that was it in a nutshell, really. I just decided that I didn't want to do lab work.
And number two?
But there were just two of us in the end doing some of the chemical analysis for the physical chemistry side. Because I don't know what the other chemists went on to do, but it was just my fellow student and I in the lab, making holes in our lab overcoats, dropping things on it.
What sorts of things were you doing that ended up producing holes in lab coats?
Oh, I probably sort of wiped beakers with sulfuric acid or something that I hadn't measured out properly and it had dropped over, and I sort of wiped it on the clothing, not really thinking.
How did you feel about working with chemicals and getting holes in coats and clothes?
It didn't worry me at all.
So in the first clip, a technician, Barbara Bowen, recalls forming herself as a non-chemist through very particular relations with equipment, fluids and clothes. And in the second, a similar assemblage of bits and pieces allows geologist Janet Thompson to perform a very different sense of self. By relating to these things outside of herself, jars, acids and clothes in a certain way, she can construct herself as unfussy, capable, unconcerned, comfortable. And we'll stay with Janet Thompson, the lady in the second clip, for the rest of this talk. In 1985, she became the first female geologist allowed to do scientific work in Antarctica with the British Antarctic Survey, that's 1985. Less subtle or detailed work than our own might simply write her up as a pioneering woman and leave it at that. But oral history allows us to look more closely at the relations between her subjectivity and her scientific work. But the question really for today is how to do this. Do we ignore the fact that she was one of a small number of women in a science, geology, that tended to regard fieldwork as a male activity? I'll start with a bad example of questioning, of my own questioning. Here I asked Janet about undergraduate geology in a way that's really obviously informed by my own reading of something in the history of geography, some sort of academic work, and it jars particularly awkwardly and embarrassingly.
Was there anything masculine in the tone or content or presentation of this fieldwork?
How do you mean?
Well, in talking about fieldwork, in demonstrating fieldwork, in moving through the landscape, in the things that were carried, the kind of conduct in the field, was there anything about that that was being subconsciously presented as masculine, as, for example, intrepid in a masculine way, or as arduous in a masculine way? Is there anything about the kind of presentation of the academic geologist in the field on these trips that struck you at the time as being masculine?
No, I don't think so. We were all expected to keep up with these chaps leaping over the rocks and up the hills, and most of us did manage to keep up. The prof was a smoker, and he did struggle a bit on hills anyway, so he wasn't striding out ahead of us by too far.
So it's rather awkward and tightened up, and it's like sort of two different kinds of analysis not mapping onto each other, and all we end up learning really is that the professor smoked, which perhaps wasn't necessary to record for posterity. But you may know that folklorist Catherine Borland found a similar sort of jarring mismatch when she attempted to sort of beam feminist analysis onto her grandmother's life. I think it's rather similar. So much better than what I did there, perhaps, is to not ask about qualities of maleness and femaleness directly, but simply to ask what people do or did. And here I just ask for an account of remembered practices. I just ask for a story of fieldwork.
Is there, across the 3 years, one perhaps day field trip, or perhaps it was one of the weekend ones or a longer trip, one that you can remember in particular that you could describe as a sort of story about it from start to finish, saying what you did when and that sort of thing? Is there one?
One of the first ones was the Easter vacation trip in the first year, and we went up to Edinburgh. But anyway, on this day we were heading out in the coach to the Pentland Hills, and we were going to look for gratulites, these very hard to spot pencil-like inscriptions on pieces of slate. And we got out of the coach and we were walking over the moor to where there was an outcrop, and it began to snow. And it was very wet snow. And it was only just starting really as we got to the outcrop, but when you're trying to look for a very faint fossil on a piece of slate that's got snowdrops melting on it, it's actually quite difficult. And we were doing our best to sort this one out, but in the end the snow got so much that we had to stomp to the coach. But the coach had moved in the meantime because he'd driven round to where we were expecting to come off the moor on the other side. So it was actually quite a long walk. And the snow was pretty thick. And a lot of people were getting quite distressed about it because they were getting cold. But I didn't mind. I had got corduroy trousers on and they were just absorbing the moisture, and whilst I kept walking, you know, it was pretty good insulation. I wasn't getting cold. And I remember Grace saying when we got back to the coach, "Well, I can see you're going to be a geologist, Janet," because I wasn't moaning, I was just sort of enjoying the challenge of getting out in the elements. So we didn't do a great deal of geology that day. I mean, we did find a few graptolites that somebody collected some samples, and then we looked at them and they dried out back in the hotel. But it was a way of sort of showing how the weather can inhibit what you're doing in the way of field work, and you have to be prepared to take it all in your stride, really. So that was a, you know, sort of enjoyed it, enjoyed the challenge.
So here again, just like with the chemistry laboratory, Janet remembers assembling herself as a particular kind of female scientist through relations with things outside of herself, with the weather, with corduroy, with terrain, with the complaints of others, with an improving comment, with very wet snow. Being unfussy, quietly competent, able to make do, these qualities are not, I'm arguing, internal, coherent psychological qualities. They are performed in a sort of folding of the outside in and the inside out. Snow and trousers and topography are bound up with a particular sense of self. Janet's construction of herself as fussy, quietly competent, unshowy, even staid, runs through memories of childhood dancing and of 1970s and 80s popular feminism. Here's dancing.
And then one of the things that she thought her young daughters should participate in was dancing classes. My sister was very keen on this, and there was a lady not very far from where we lived. She had a big old house with a little sort of gymnasium out the back. And young girls went there to learn acrobatics and tap dancing and ballet dancing. And my sister had already been going, I think, for a couple of years, and she really enjoyed it. And my mother thought that I should also go, and I wasn't too keen on this. I was a bit cautious as a child, trying new things. And I went and watched the girls doing handstands and walking on their hands and all this sort of thing, and I didn't think that that was what I really wanted to do. But I was not allowed to be a wallflower for more than a couple of times, and I did do it, and I could tolerate these things, but what I did not like was the Christmas performances or the summer carnivals, when the school was members were, you went on a float, you know, and you were paraded around in the streets. I don't like being the focus of attention. And there was one Christmas concert that I remember where my sister was part of a trio of girls doing the can-can. And for some reason, I was a small white rabbit. I was asked to sit on the stage, and I was given a carrot to nibble because I enjoyed raw carrots, just to sort of keep me in a good mood. But I turned my back on the audience to eat this carrot, and there was lots of tittering going on because I wouldn't do anything else when I nibble this huge carrot throughout the performance. So I didn't enjoy that. I have never liked performing on stage, and I've always tried to get out of it.
So, from a memory of her childhood to popular feminism,
To what extent were you aware of and or even involved with sort of popular feminist movements of the time?
I was aware of them, and I wasn't particularly happy because they tended to be rather strident. I think that that probably was essential, just to make people sit up and take notice, but it wasn't the way that I wanted to behave.
Can you think of specific examples of kinds of feminist strident behaviour that you felt was not the approach you wanted to take?
I can't think of anything specific. There was always rather, there was an awful lot of shouting on the radio that I remember hearing by very articulate ladies. Nobody within my own sphere of acquaintances, but it would be what I heard on the radio or read about in the paper. I can't remember specifics. But it, I can't quite put my finger on it. I just didn't want to be branded as one of them, you know, sort of stroppy female who shouted the whole time and didn't do anything.
So I've got a question for you which you can consider and answer at the end. And that's, what does the apparent stability of this unshowy, quietly competent, determined sense of self across Janet's life mean? The fact that she's saying similar things about herself as a child, about her reaction to feminism on the radio, about her response to fieldwork. Does it undermine the argument that I've tried to make about identity? Does it suggest that far from constructing yourself in relation to other things, each person from child to adult has a fairly stable interior self? So is there a core self which interviewees may not readily reveal, but which is there? And if so, should we be asking them about their dreams or their fantasies or looking for an unconscious or something? Or does it merely reflect the fact that the life story interview is just the most recent or just another social practice through which the individual assembles themselves together, using memories and photos and things? And we'll end today with another questionable question. Rob listened to my interview with Janet, and he thought that the question you're about to hear was a leading one. He put, "Beware leading questions about gender." It came at a point in the interview when Janet was talking about a period in the late 70s when she was forced to work on rock samples collected in Antarctica by male geologists because under Bass rules she wasn't allowed to go herself. So the scientists would bring back samples, perhaps they weren't interested to work on them themselves, but she could work on them back at base, but wasn't allowed to go and collect her own, or to go and see where they'd been collected from, exactly. The clip begins with her already talking, and she's describing how she tried to work out where exactly the rock samples had been collected from, and then comes the question that is leading.
He also did put photo numbers as well. Sometimes, not always. So when I got the photographs, I put on the back of those all the station numbers that were on the negative strips, the envelope that they were in. So that was further evidence to help me find out where he'd been.
So at this time you're reconstructing where a male geologist has been to collect samples that you're working on. You're hearing stories of Antarctic travel in the research room one. Mm-hmm. How did you feel at that stage about the fact that you didn't have access to Antarctica?
Pretty cross. I just wanted to get there and actually go over the same terrain myself and sort of see where this person had been and get a better feel for how the different rocks related to each other. Well, I thought it was daft that somebody should be expected to work on samples that hadn't been collected by that person, because I had done geology because it was a field subject, and that you needed to sort of get your hands dirty and collecting the samples and relating to the environment from which they're being collected, and to sort of almost trying to research the geology blindfolded, not having collected them for myself. So I did find it very frustrating and illogical, really, that I should be expected to do it. And I was also cross because it was the gender issue that was sort of dawning on me, really, and I thought that was stupid too. So I wanted to go for the reason of seeing it for myself, that particular location, but also going because they shouldn't stop me because I'm a woman. You know, I think that was the start of feeling that it was a rather improper segregation of scientists, because they were male or female, depending, you know, whether they could go to the Antarctic or not.
No. Whether or not it was leading, I think it was. The pretty cross, when she says she was pretty cross, isn't very convincing. And I suppose the question is, does my question set up a kind of tension along gender lines that wasn't there, or not there in exactly the way that she says? How close is the account of her feelings to the feelings actually felt at the time? How might I have better approached this? And alongside this specific question and the others that I've asked in the talk, I suppose the more general question for discussion is, how should maleness and femaleness be asked about, if at all, directly, in future interviews?
Okay. I think there might be a round of applause.